Welcome to The Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fawley-Love and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On The Director's Chair, I sit down with political leaders, policymakers, and commentators in order to understand what's happening in the world. My guest today is former British diplomat, traveller, author, and politician Rory Stewart. Rory is one of the most interesting figures on the world stage. Born in Hong Kong, Rory spent his childhood in Malaysia and Scotland, and then passed through a number of establishment institutions, including Eton, Balliol, the Black Watch, the Foreign Office, and according to speculation, the Secret Intelligence Service. He was a summer tutor to Princes William and Harry. And yet, Rory has also repeatedly gone off-piste and done fascinating and indeed sometimes remarkable things with his life. He served as a diplomat in Jakarta and Montenegro before giving up diplomacy to walk almost 10,000 kilometres across Asia, becoming the first person to walk across Afghanistan after the US-led invasion. In 2003, in the aftermath of another invasion, he served as deputy governor of two Iraqi provinces. In 2010, he left Harvard University, where he was teaching, to return to the UK and enter the House of Commons as the Tory member for Penrith and the Border. In the past decade, he served as a minister in several portfolios and briefly in the cabinet as the Secretary of State for International Development. Then he was a candidate for the Conservative Party leadership, and finally he was an independent candidate for Mayor of London. It's been quite a ride. Rory is joining me from his home in the United Kingdom. Thank you, Rory Stewart, for agreeing to speak with me today on The Director's Chair.
Thank you very much.
All right, Rory, let me start by asking about your origin story, if I can. Your father, Brian Stewart, was involved in the secret world for several decades, and in the 1970s, I think he was in the running to become the chief of MI6, or C. Tell us a bit about your youth and the impact that your father's life and work had on the path that you've taken in life.
Well, my father was a huge influence on me, as I guess fathers often are. He died aged 93, 5 years ago. He fought in the war as an officer in the Black Watch, was wounded in the Normandy campaign, then was a Malayan civil servant, so he was a British colonial officer in Malaya, and then served with the British Secret Service, with MI6, all the way across Asia. He had postings in almost every Asian country, including being our representative in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, where he was actually bombed by American planes. He was 50 when I was born. He was coming to the end of his career there. He was by then the deputy head of the Secret Service, and as you say, was in the running to be the chief. And I guess by the time I was 4 or 5, had realized that he was moving towards a new stage in his life and put a lot of time into his little boy. He would spend 2 or 3 hours every morning taking me to Hyde Park to fence in the park or to play. And then when we moved to Malaysia, he would build rafts in the jungle and take me down the river. And it was a lovely thing. I mean, for somebody who had had a strange life, his only brother was killed in the war. They were very close, only a year apart. And his father had been in India, hadn't seen much of his father when he was growing up. And his father was a Victorian figure born in 1880. But my father somehow responded to all of that by being a very, very emotional, very loving father, a very modern father, which you wouldn't have expected so much from a man of that generation.
I've heard you say that one of your heroes as a young man was Alexander the Great, and I think you named your rocking horse Bucephalus after Alexander's famous horse. Isn't this really setting yourself up for disappointment, Rory?
I did definitely setting yourself up for disappointment in your late 20s, early 30s. I think that's right. I very much was obsessed with the idea of these big classical heroes when I was growing up. And I think I had an idea that I was going to be some grand sort of world historical figure. It's an idea, though, that I sensed probably then, and now I'm absolutely convinced, you can't really continue beyond your late 20s, early 30s. And it's no accident that a lot of these kind of figures, whether it is Alexander the Great or whether it's romantic poets like Byron or Keats or Shelley, a lot of them died in their late 20s, early 30s. It's very much a young man's fantasy, and it doesn't really work with actually growing up and realizing that in the end, you're just one person amongst many, many other people. And that, yeah, the challenge of life, I suppose, is overcoming that kind of fierce egotism of adolescence.
That's a dog at your end, is it?
It could be dog, could be birds. There's a lot of wildlife.
Now that you're in your late 40s and you've had a career in politics, do you think that history is made by individuals or movements?
Well, I suppose you do see up close the influence of individuals a great deal in politics. At the same time, you also feel the powerlessness of individuals. I wish I could find a way of explaining the magic formula. My sense of politics is that you are often stuck for months and years in a rut where it feels as though an individual can do almost nothing to change anything. And then suddenly a moment will come where an individual can achieve an enormous amount of very, very rapid change and things can shift very quickly. I found at a much smaller level in my jobs in government that I had almost no influence on most of my government departments until I found myself in prisons, where I was able to make a lot of quite rapid changes as the prisons minister responsible for the prisons in England and Wales within a few weeks. Thinking back on that, I realized that for an individual to make a lot of difference quickly, you need to be very lucky. You need a very fortunate context. In my case, I was only able to do that because I had a boss that I got on with that was willing to let me do that. I had a government that was distracted by Brexit, so they weren't interfering too much. I had an organization that was in a particular type of crisis. So, you know, I'm avoiding, I suppose, Michael, the sense of this, but certainly looking at British politics, we tend to read it as a situation in which only really Churchill and Mrs. Thatcher made really dramatic, perhaps Attlee in a smaller way, but probably only two or three prime ministers since the war have made really dramatic differences. And the rest of them, it's much more difficult to see what kind of impact they had. And that must be something to do with the personalities, but also something to do with the time. Sorry, back to you, Michael.
I mean, wouldn't you say that Boris Johnson has changed the course of British history quite substantially? I mean, couldn't you make an argument that absent Boris supporting the Brexit case, Brits wouldn't have voted for Brexit in 2016?
I think you can, Michael. You can, absolutely. He is a formidable campaigner, particularly at that point, had an astonishing popularity and an astonishing ability to reach the public. And given that that referendum was only won by a couple of points, it's perfectly plausible to argue that he was worth a couple of points to that campaign. But we know that. We know that when he ran to be mayor of London, he beat the national figures for the Conservative Party by a number of percentage points. And of course, on coming in and appointing this guy, Dominic Cummings, as chief of staff, who's very, very radical, and allowing Cummings to do what he wants, he's also changed the Conservative Party very dramatically and the Constitution very dramatically. He began to do things like suspend Parliament, take on the Supreme Court, and then ultimately expel from the party a lot of the traditional centre ground, the One Nation Conservatives, he managed to get rid of almost overnight. I was one of 21 rebels who he stripped the whip off almost immediately, and by doing so, changed the party very dramatically. So you're absolutely right. And I think it's also true that his response to COVID was a very Boris-like response. Had there been a different prime minister, we could have had a very different response to those things. So, yes, I think Boris is somebody who will be seen as having changed things. And that's it's at odds with the fact that in another role, though, as foreign secretary, he changed almost nothing. He had almost no measurable impact, I felt, when I was the foreign office minister working for him on British foreign policy during his tenure. But you're absolutely right, in the few short months as campaigning on Brexit and as Prime Minister, he's had a lot of impact.
You served for nearly a decade in the House of Commons as an MP. How did you find politics when you look back on it? Was it a great adventure or a great disappointment?
For me, closer to a great disappointment. I'm still struggling to write about politics because I'm afraid so much of it makes me very, very angry and depressed. And I'd like to write a book about it, but I'd like a book to be engaging and the sort of thing you'd want to read. And at the moment, when I try to write it, it's pretty depressing. I'm not quite sure why I find it so enraging, but I felt so strongly that my colleagues were less than the sum of their parts, that many of them were, as individuals outside the House of Commons and before they entered the House of Commons, decent people, but somehow getting into that building brought out the very worst in almost everybody. The level of debate in the House of Commons was terrible, not just in the chamber, but also informally when we met in bars and coffee shops to chat. People didn't talk about policy seriously. They were astonishing. Lyndon Johnson makes this joke about saying that if you want a friend in politics, get a dog.
Boris did.
He did get a dog, Michael. No, but it still beggars belief, the levels of the betrayals that I saw in politics, people's ability to say one thing and do the other the next day, the sense that nobody felt, not nobody, but that many of the key top players felt absolutely no shame at all about trying to live up to what they would have said or promised 3 or 4 days earlier. And a lot of the people I liked most, a lot of the most thoughtful, serious people in politics left with me, were people who, like me, rebelled against a hard Brexit and have now been thrown out of the party. So, yeah, I'm left a bit bruised by the experience of politics.
You wouldn't recommend to your sons, for example, that they go into politics?
No, absolutely not. If you're a very, very saintly figure, which I'm not, you may be able to survive it. But for somebody like me, I find it brings out the very worst in me. I think politics is bad for your health. You're stuffed in this ridiculous building until late at night, unable to exercise or get any fresh air. It's bad for your mind because you're being made to be very, very careful with what you say, very cautious about thinking openly. It's very bad for your soul because there's a lot of pressure on loyalty and just doing what you're told and not thinking independently. All these things are not good for your character. So I think unless you're a heroic saint, I wouldn't recommend going into politics.
You had a pretty good crack at changing politics. And you first of all did that in your really audacious campaign to lead the Conservative Party. And we saw, you know, the Rory Walks theme. Walking is a great theme of your life from Afghanistan and Asia and all around Britain. And you ran a different kind of campaign and you really tried to harness people power, as it were. And it didn't work. Now, tell me, was it fun running for leader of the Conservative Party? And do you think you would have made a good prime minister if you'd been successful?
So running for leader of the Conservative Party prime minister was the most enjoyable, satisfying thing I did in politics, apart from being prison minister. Those are the two things that I'll remember most positively. It was fantastic. I decided that I would do it by getting out to every part of Britain that I could get to. I traveled very, very quickly. And I filmed myself with a mobile telephone talking to everyone on random street corners in Wigan. And I found it so exciting to be able to do politics in that way. I literally would stand at Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park and speak to 400 or 500 people and just try to involve people in politics. And for the first time, I was really able to ask myself, not what is the Conservative Party manifesto, but what do I think are the right things to do in the country? So all the ideas that have been bubbling away for 9, 10 years, I could present as my platform. And I also had the real excitement of engaging and making the argument around Brexit, trying to make an argument for a soft Brexit, trying to find that middle ground, saying, okay, the referendum's happened. I don't think we can have a second referendum, but we don't need to go for a hard Brexit. We can look at a Norway or a Swiss model, remain close to the European Union, even if we're not in. So that arguing for the middle ground, that getting out and touching people, those things really, really moved and excited me. I loved all that. I think the question of whether I'd make a good prime minister, I still don't know. I still don't know. It's a very, very strange job being prime minister. There are so many dimensions to it which you cannot be prepared for just by being a member of the cabinet or a member of the National Security Council. And I think anybody who becomes prime minister feels that total shift into a different universe. I think there are bits of the job that I hope I would have been strong at. I think I'm reasonably good at responding to crises and emergency operations. So probably the things that I did best at government were responding to crises in prisons, to violence in prisons, to flooding when I was the flooding minister. I think I would have been reasonably good, for example, responding to something like coronavirus, because it draws on that side of my personality, which likes emergencies and is good at that kind of crisis management. Whether I would have been as good at the long-term media handling, whether I would have been able to keep the House of Commons on side, whether I would have had the nerve to do what Boris did, which was to call a general election from a very, very weak position and then win a big majority, that's a bit questionable. And of course, had I become prime minister, I would have faced a huge problem, which is that a huge amount of the Conservative Party were hard Brexiteers, and they would have had a prime minister pushing for soft Brexit. So I suspect that had I taken over, I would have had to do some very radical things about reaching out to a coalition of other parties and forming a national government to get my policies through.
Let me ask you about Brexit. What effect now do you think Brexit will have on Britain? Do you think it will be as bad as you feared?
Oh, yeah, I think it's a terrible thing. I think it's something where, particularly in the aftermath of coronavirus, it's where our economy lost 20% in a month, and where we're desperate to rebuild. The economic risks of Brexit, of cutting off trade with Europe, which is 50% of our exports, losing that trade with Europe, of the economic damage that we can do through Brexit is going to be very, very difficult. And I think if you add to that the decision to abolish the Department for International Development and our handling of the coronavirus crisis, it is difficult to feel that Britain is going to be able to emerge from this in the way that people like Boris hope, suddenly as a much strengthened global power. I feel that this weakens us, that we were on a better brand as part of the European Union. Under Mr. Thatcher and Tony Blair, we had managed to consolidate and develop our reputation as a significant mid-ranking power, a power that could easily hold its head up high alongside France or Germany, play a decent role in the UN Security Council, and play an important role internationally. I think what we're doing now feels very, very odd. And this is the awful thing which I think Brexiteers suspect, and they hate people like me saying, which is that I'm simply not confident that we have the depth of capacity, resources, institutions, skills to be able to go it alone in the way that they fantasize. Now, they see that as a defeatist, pessimistic view. But I'm afraid that our system in Britain has been so arranged around the European Union for more than 40 years. And in a broader sense, our foreign policy is so arranged about our relationship with the United States that in a world of Trump and Brexit, Britain finds itself in a difficult situation.
Now, a few months ago, British politics was all about Brexit. Now it's all about COVID. And this is a topic on which you were remarkably prescient. And a number of us have watched, or many of us really have watched, your interventions in March, where you came out very strongly against the then British policy, it seemed, of trying to generate herd immunity to the coronavirus. And you criticised the government for responding too slowly, and you call for lockdown measures, the kinds of lockdown measures that were eventually enacted. But I'm interested in where you got the confidence to stake your credibility on that issue, given that you're not a scientist, you don't have particular expertise in that area, and given that the British scientific establishment was lined up against you. Now, your view was in line with that was taken by other national governments, but still, it takes an enormous amount of pluck to take a stand like that.
Well, Michael, thank you. The truth, of course, is that in a lot of the things that I've done in public life, I've had to take those kinds of stands. So, for example, in relation to Afghanistan, I was very, very early in saying that I did not think the intervention in Afghanistan was going to work, that the US surge wasn't going to work, the counterinsurgency strategy wouldn't work. And of course, I was used then to going up against a lot of experts. There were many, many people who were profoundly informed who disagreed with me. I remember being on a big, big public meeting and somebody saying to me, "Are you disagreeing with America's most decorated general?" And having to say, "Yes, I am disagreeing with America's most decorated general." So I think I got used to the idea that in relation to crisis management in a complicated society, there are not simple things called experts, that these are always a question of human judgment. And above all, their judgments about your own government and the instincts of that government. So yes, the epidemiologists know a lot about viruses, but they're not being asked to make decisions just about viruses. They're being asked to make decisions about schools, about public morale, about the economy. Very, very complex things, very difficult to predict. And in the end, it comes down to your intuition about whether the people at the top are good at listening to uncomfortable truths. are they quick enough at making decisions? Or are they going to fall, as I feel we often fall in government, particularly in British government, into a complacent business as usual? We'll wait a bit longer. We'll ask for more information. We don't want to do anything too radical. We don't want to do anything costly. A sort of combination of optimism and a desire not to rock the boat. And what I sensed immediately with coronavirus was not very different from what I'd seen with British policy on Afghanistan, and not very different from what I'd seen actually on British response to flooding when I was the environment minister, which was a terrible sense that I knew those people around the cabinet table, I knew the senior civil servants, and I sensed that when they were saying they were listening to the scientific advice, they were not challenging it enough, and that it suited them to listen to the scientific advice, because the scientific advice was basically encouraging them to do less rather than more, encouraging them not to shut things down, encouraging them not to take the economic hit, encouraging them not to make the radical choices. And usually, in a crisis, the difficult radical choices made immediately are the right things to do.
It's interesting you say you had a feel for the instincts of the British government, because I would say, as an outsider, British government and the establishment has always had a reputation for effectiveness and competence. And I'd say one of the big blows to your country's prestige over the last 5 years is how the establishment has let so many crazy things happen. I mean, first of all, voting effectively to make your country smaller and weaker and less connected to the world in Brexit, allowing that referendum to take place, allowing it to be lost. And then again, this sort of wobble on herd immunity. You know, we've always thought that the British establishment focuses laser-like on its interests and sort of gets the mail through. The last 5 years, I think, has shaken the confidence of a lot of us in British institutions.
I think that's right. And I think you're right to make that point. I think those institutions, of course, were very much dependent on a particular culture and group of people and a particular way of thinking. It wasn't about our formal constitution. It wasn't about the technical design of those institutions. It was that they had a particular history. And a lot of that history was to do with a particular vigorous respect, mutual respect between senior civil servants and senior ministers, and a sense that they were engaged in a joint project, which wasn't easy to maintain in the modern world. I mean, a lot of it was quite old-fashioned. If I think back to when my father was a senior civil servant, most of the senior permanent secretaries in the early 1970s, in fact, I think every single one in the early 1970s, was the product of a grammar school education. These were not, you know, aristocratic public schoolboys. They were people who'd come often from quite modest backgrounds, done very well at school, but had then gone on to Oxford and Cambridge and had then joined the civil service and were putting very, very formidable brains into their work. And regardless of whether they were working with Labour or Conservative governments, there was a strong sense of the mutual role of ministers and senior civil servants. And set against them were, of course, ministers, many of whom had very distinguished war records up until the mid-1980s, late 1980s. And therefore themselves had a sense of how governments go wrong, how governments work in crises. So that collapsed, and it collapsed partly under Blair and partly under Cameron, and it's collapsing faster now. We are a less serious country. Everything seems more tokenistic. People are moving much more quickly between roles. People have much less deep experience. Sometimes the intellectual caliber, both of our senior ministers and senior civil servants, may not be that of the past. And certainly people no longer put the time into policy. Things are much more driven by short-term press releases, and that creates a culture where it's difficult to ask tough questions. And Michael, what is your reflection on this question of what's happening to British policymaking? I'm not sure that my slightly pompous description of civil servants and ministers is the key to it, but something's odd.
I think in a way it goes back to this question of individuals and individual decisions. Because I think, like, if you took David Cameron's decision to hold a referendum and Boris's decision to campaign in the referendum, absent those two contributions, Britain would not be Brexiting. And that's 5 years of bandwidth that you would have got back. So I don't know if it's vast impersonal changes in the British system or it's individual mistakes that individual British politicians made that have now sort of broken something, that have broken something in the system. We have something similar in Australia where you might remember about 10 years ago, Kevin Rudd, who'd just been elected prime minister, was then rolled as prime minister by his party room.
Yeah.
And we then had a succession of coups. And you can ask what's changed. Why did Australia go from being the most stable developed country to the least stable developed country? And you could say it's social media, but I think it's the fact that they broke the mold. And once you break the vessel, you can't reconstruct it. And maybe that's what's happened to Britain, that once that thing happened with Brexit, you know, it just sort of broke so many relationships and your relationship with the truth and your relationship with expertise.
I think that's right. I also think that there's a sense in which nothing seemed very serious. These people were not used to actually dealing with anything that mattered because everything was pretty easy and comfortable in Britain. So politics could feel to them much more like a game, and they weren't well equipped because even their participation in things like Afghanistan and Iraq was very much as a junior partner to the United States. They never needed to really think through from first principles whether what they were doing made sense. Because they almost couldn't, because they were bound to an American policy. So it's been a very long time since the British system has actually had to make really profound, fundamental decisions that really mattered. You know, the system felt very, very resilient. The world was very comfortable. We hadn't had war. So they weren't actually used to dealing with real crises. So I think their inability to respond to coronavirus was partly that. These are comfortable people who grew up in a world where, you know, obviously Michael Gove and Boris Johnson were journalists, grew up in a world of bright ideas and fun things and having a bit of a game and nothing really mattering. And I think it's the lack of seriousness that's so striking.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, there was that Simon Cooper article that you read in the FT about how, you know, Oxford was to blame, actually, or the Oxford Union was to blame. There is something to that.
Well, I think that was always there, but somehow I think the traditional idea was supposed to be that people were meant to have a deep moral compass and a deep sense of values and then wear it lightly and pretend that it was a bit of a game, a bit like them pretending not to do any work before their finals. Or it was, you know, there was a part of the Victorian idea that you were understated and modest and had a stiff upper lip and treated serious things quite lightly. But it wasn't supposed to be a real lack of seriousness. It was supposed to be a manner that seemed unserious. The problem is that the manner is now all that we've got left. We're lacking what the Victorians would have balanced it with, which was a deep sense of values and moral purpose, warring with a lighthearted tone. We now just have the lighthearted tone.
Mm. Speaking of cultural changes, can I ask you about the Black Lives Matter movement that is taking off around the world, including in your country, and also the rise of cancel culture, which is a part of that, the pulling down of statues, the Roads Must Fall campaign in the UK. How do you feel about that shift in culture?
I think it's absolutely inevitable in British culture, and it's something that we should expect and we should respond to rapidly. I think that we are a culture which has, particularly in London, an incredibly diverse community. More than 50% of the population of London was not born in the United Kingdom, and an astonishing almost two-thirds of the population of London are not white British. Now, there'll be many parts of Australia where you'll have the same phenomenon, but it's something that Britain has been struggling with, partly because so many of our institutions, and this is partly, again, to go back to the fact we don't have a written constitution and this, that, and the other, are based on slow historical evolution from a much more white British culture that hasn't fully thought through how to adjust to the modern world. I think we need to be much quicker and more nimble, and I don't think there is a great harm. Many of my conservative colleagues are very worried by Black Lives Matter. Many of my ex-conservative colleagues feel this is some great national crisis. I think these are things that we can engage with confidently and ought to engage with confidently. I can't see why the foreign secretary isn't prepared to take the knee. I can't see why we shouldn't be comfortable getting involved in a conversation about statues. I don't think this needs to be seen as an existential threat to Britain. I think a secure, confident country would accept that many precious members of our society, many British citizens, feel deeply uncomfortable with parts of British history, and we can accommodate them relatively easily, and we should be doing so.
Let me ask you, in May, you pulled out of the race to be Mayor of London. What's next for you, Rory? You've done so many things, so many different things in your life, soldiering, diplomacy, aid work, academia, politics, perhaps some other jobs as well. What's left? What's next?
So, Michael, I mean, I'd like to spend some time teaching and writing if I could. But as I say, I'm struggling a little bit to work out how to write a book that anyone would want to read. Mm-hmm. I'm loving, obviously, having a bit of a break and spending a huge amount of time with my 3-year-old and 5-year-old, where, you know, I began by talking a little bit about how lucky I was to have a father who could spend time with me. Mm-hmm. And that's something that COVID has allowed me to do suddenly in a way that I never was able to before. Many days I couldn't see my children at all from morning until night, and now suddenly I'm seeing them regularly. But I think probably I will lean more into international things, in international development or humanitarian work, because I feel that it's difficult for an ex-politician to do things in Britain without being tarred with the brush of the fact that you used to belong to a particular political party.
Well, thank you, Rory, for joining me on the director's chair to reflect on your career and on British politics. Many people certainly think you have a lot to offer public life, so we look forward to seeing what you do next. In the meantime, I hope we can get you down to Sydney at some point. We have a very large continent to ourselves in Australia, so there's plenty of opportunity for walking here, Rory.
Michael, thank you for having me. That was great.
You've been listening to The Director's Chair, a podcast by the Lowy Institute, hosted by me, Michael Fullilove, with production assistance from Madeline Neist. Thanks for listening, and please tune in to the next episode of The Director's Chair.